This episode is brought to you by Bombas. Summer's here and we're all chasing something. Maybe it's a break, a goal, a vibe. Well, let's not let bad socks and blisters ruin it. I know in my household, we are not letting that happen because my wife and I love Bombas socks. In fact, it's pretty much all we wear right now because they are such a step up in quality from your usual socks. They are comfortable, they are soft, they are functional, they're not going to fall down during the day, so you have to keep pulling them up. And guess what? They look good too, so maybe you want to look stylish for a wedding. It's wedding season. Well, Bombas has great stuff that's going to make you the best dressed guest. And if you're a runner like Paul, well, Bombas running socks, they wick sweat, they help keep you cool and fight blisters, but they also make specialized pairs for tennis, golf, hiking, you name it. And of course, we all love Bombas Mission, where one pair purchased equals one donated to someone who needs it. Head over to bombas.com and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com, code CURB at checkout. Bombas.com and use the code CURB. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. With Mint, you can get the coverage and speed you're used to, but for way less money. And for a limited time, Mint Mobile is offering 3 months of unlimited premium wireless service for $15 a month. So while your friends are sweating over data overages and surprise charges, you'll be chilling, literally and financially. Say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans of Mint Mobile come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch the overpriced wireless and get 3 months of unlimited service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. Listen, I'm with one of the big wireless carriers, and it's time to ditch them because my bills are way too high, and it's time to move over to Mint Mobile. So this year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get this new customer offer and your 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/curb. That's mintmobile.com/curb. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 per month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're ready.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Well, hi. Hi, Paul.
Hi, everybody. Okay. Yesterday, we forgot to mention everyone that was here until the Chris's surprisingly jumped in. So let's start.
We are here.
Yeah, let's start.
We've got Chris and Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
Chew Man, you want to introduce yourself?
Chris Chu, the attending MedPeds guy on the show.
Hey, this is Chris Thrash.
Aren't you another attending MedPeds guy on the show?
I am. Yeah.
Chris and Chris are MedPeds guys.
Okay.
Our spinoff show soon to come.
Soon to come. Yep. And you guys live together? Is that right?
Don't tell my wife.
What you can see is they're sharing a microphone. It's like a Springsteen performance. This is pretty magical.
Yeah. Maybe next year we'll have a budget for more microphones. But for right now, I think we're doing okay.
Waiting for that innovation grant to come through.
Yes. Yeah.
Should I tell you guys I left one in my room?
We're back to tell you more high-yield pearls that we found from today at the conference, actually, and a little bit from yesterday, because we went to some sessions after we recorded yesterday's, and that's what we're going to start off with here. We went to the consult guys, and actually, we've been planning to do a show, almost, I guess you could call it a crossover show, with the consult guys to have them come on and talk with us about perioperative medicine. And that's going to be pushed off by a month or two now because they, in their talk yesterday, they mentioned this study called the METS study, which was the protocol was in the British Medical Journal in 2016. It's a study where they're going to follow, where they have followed 1,700 plus patients 1 year post-op. All the patients that were in this trial got a cardiopulmonary exercise stress test plus a Duke Duke Activity Index and a serum NT-proBNP, and then they follow these patients out. The primary outcome they're looking at is all-cause mortality or non-fatal MI within 30 days of their major non-cardiac surgery. And while we don't know what the results are yet, the consult guys tell us that this is going to be practice changing. So hopefully we will be able to do a nice episode with them on that and really figure out this whole perioperative medicine thing, which has always given me some anxiety, which is why I want to do an episode on it.
You know
what?
I'm sure
this is going to validate serial stress testing. I think
this
time is finally due.
Wonderful.
Every adult over 50 should have a yearly stress 100%. Test. Yeah.
Yeah. What I came away from the consult guys was actually that Mona Lisa has a mystery diagnosis, and you guys have to figure it out.
And they could follow your Twitter. They could follow your Twitter, Stuart, if they want to figure that out. Chewman, you had something to say about kind of related.
Yeah. So one of the talks that I went to was a panel of doctors talking about perioperative anticoagulation management, including Stephen Mall, Dr. Vern, and Dr. Villas Gonzalez. Basically, one of the first points I took away from it was that basically when you have an endoscopic procedure, even with the high risk ones, stopping aspirin is rarely indicated. I think one of the big things I took away from it was basically one of the journal articles which had the 2016 ASGE guidelines for endoscopy and antithrombotic agents that came out in 2016 in the Journal of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. So I think if you guys look that up, it'll answer most of your questions. Some of the things that came out of that talk include restarting NOACs after polypectomy. Usually they recommend 1 or 2 days. Definitely talk to your endoscopist about that, as well as with urgent endoscopies and emergent endoscopies. Most people are fine with scoping with INRs less than 2.5. There's a little bit of debate on how to get people down there, but especially with a NOAC or a DOAC, four-factor PCC might be the most common use of that, for that, I should say. Going on to reversals, also with medications like dabigatran, basically hemodialysis is no longer indicated because of the reversal agent, which is, I don't know, you guys can help me pronounce it.
Nope.
I can't help you.
Adrenocarbamazepine. Anyhow, overall, the study showed that it's rapid and safe. With the 10 inhibitors, they have andexanet alpha, which I think they say might be approved in the next month or so. Until then, PCCs, the force factor PCCs, can be used as well.
And that's for the 10A?
Mm-hmm, for the 10A inhibitors. And then for antiplatelets, you know, they just recommend, you know, treating with platelet agents. I think the last speaker then just was talking about valvular disease, and I think the most interesting part was he gets asked all the time about stopping anticoagulation for cataract surgery, and he said, would you stop anticoagulation if you went to Supercuts for a haircut? And the answer is no. So
so he's saying that the technical difficulty of a cataract surgery is equal to a haircut?
Don't tell Dr. Glockenflecken.
Excellent.
Eye barbers.
Yeah, there you go.
Basically, half our audience just heard, stop your anticoagulant when you get a haircut.
Well, some of what we went to today was actually about the hidden curriculum. Dr. Williams, did you have any comments on that?
I mean, I have no powerful insights. I mean, I think it's stuff that we kind of intuitively know already. So in case you're not familiar with the concept, the hidden curriculum is in contradistinction to the overt curriculum. So there's the stuff that we teach, and then the stuff that we teach kind of implicitly by our behaviors and how we actually demonstrate our values. And so basically the takeaway point is to be aware of the hidden curriculum and just behave well in front of your learners. So try not to be callous or cynical or model behaviors that actually sort of demean a patient, and just be conscious of your own behaviors and how learners may actually pick that up. And I think that was the big takeaway point that I took from that.
And also be very careful how those modeled behaviors do affect burnout down the road for those physicians who choose not to go into primary care, or actually for those who do choose to go into primary care and end up modeling those same behaviors that will ultimately lead to increased burnout down the road. So depersonification, looking at patients as hits and not necessarily as an opportunity to make an impact on their care, things like that.
that was Dr. Lehman and Dr. Desai who presented this one. And this paper was in the Annals of Internal Medicine in February 2018. And this is where I get out my own guilt on the show. So I was mentioning to Paul that when this paper came out, it really I immediately like sort of I just read, you know, even just reading like the abstract, I was like, oh, I definitely need to get on my best behavior when I'm around my learners because of, you know, modeling whether you like it or not, your learners are looking to you as like how they should behave. So I spend 2 hours a day, I'm allotted for teaching rounds, sometimes, you know, longer than that, but I need to be on my best behavior during that time and really be cognizant of what I'm doing in front of learners.
I think the way I combat that is, with all my residents and my students, I'm always constantly feeling like I want to sell them that I love what I do because I want other people to do what I do.
Yeah.
So if I'm on the wards and I'm excited about teaching and I show how cool it is to see all these different patients or even in the clinic where it can sort of be, a slog sometimes, but especially with the med students that come see me, you know, they don't know what they want to do. And I'm like, look, primary care is awesome. I get to see all these patients. People love you because they get to know you and you get this continuity with your patients. And, you know, I try to show that to my students as trying to, you know, I'm trying to sell them that I want them to do what I do.
I think one other comment I would make that you're just making me think of, I think when you walk around an office and you hear colleagues talking to each other in ways about patients that just seem really,
callous.
That's exactly the word I was looking for. I think we all need to think about that because it just normalizes the behavior and then it doesn't even seem like shocking anymore that they're talking in a callous way.
It's, you know, we've talked about this before where one of the main determinants of whether or not a learner goes into primary care is whether the role models that they have around them. And if you have primary care doctors that seem dismissive or seem like they don't respect patients, they're not going to go into primary care. So I think Chris's point is exactly right. If you role model your excitement to talk about patients and see patients and really care for people, I think that's a way to keep people within medicine. And also that, as Stuart points out, that will ameliorate against burnout as well.
There was actually one of the ones that you and I went to, it was from the Annals looking at some of the articles. And one of the quotes in there from the quote from the article that he was just basically reading verbatim was that you can truly fake it until you make it. And the reason why I even bring that up is because if you approach a patient as if you're happy to see the patient will reflect that same attitude that you're presenting to the patient. And it's easier to enjoy what you do if you approach it as if you already enjoy what you do. Unfortunately, it sounds really dumb. It sounds like I'm telling you to just, you know, pretend like you're enjoying what you do. But ultimately, if you do that, you will enjoy what you do.
It's like putting the pencil between your teeth. You smile and your body thinks you're happy.
That's exactly what it was from.
Yeah. Even if you're unhappy. Right. Okay. I want to move on to the GIM update stuff. Thrash, you had some Dr. Thrash, sorry.
Yeah,
you had some things to tell us there.
That's okay. Dr. Bundrick from the Mayo Clinic had some excellent points, but I think the two ones I took away were for venous stasis ulcers, which is a really difficult problem to treat. He mentioned this Cochrane review of 11 RCTs that showed, when combined, that pentoxifilin, when taken TID, those patients had a 61% either significant response or resolution of the ulcer, compared to 37% with placebo. So something else we can use, for venous stasis ulcers in addition to compression. So that's exciting. I wasn't aware of that use of pentoxifilin.
We were just roughing the stats on that. So that's like a 30% absolute risk reduction and a number needed to treat less than 5.
Yeah. Roughly. He quoted a number needed to treat a 4.
Yeah.
And to be clear, that's what the compression stock is in addition, correct?
He did not specify. He said compared to placebo, so it's hard to do placebo compression stocking. So I'm assuming that it's placebo pills and everyone. But actually, he did mention that 4 of these trials had no compression, and they did have some response with bentoxifilin alone, but not as significant as when they did with compression stocking.
So there was some heterogeneity in that data then.
Right, yeah. But okay. It's something that can be done. And Metoxifilane has some GI side effects, but and TID dosing is obviously not easy, but something besides compression that can be done.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to get a show notes for this one, but I feel like that article would be worth putting into the show notes since we're not exactly sure of the stats. Remember, we're off the cuff here, more or less.
The other case that he, and I thought this was fascinating, he described this 66-year-old woman who comes in with classic presentation, no symptoms of Graves' disease, but chemically looks like Graves' disease with a suppressed TSH, elevated free T4. And she happens to mention she's taking biotin for her nails, which apparently biotin can give you all of the chemical findings of Graves' disease, a suppressed TSH, an elevated free T4, and even false positive receptor antibodies.
Excellent.
So he recommends if your patients insist on taking biotin and you're screening them for thyroid disease, they need to hold them that supplement for 3 days prior to.
So if you want to start So if you want to start levothyroxine, just take some biotin and go see your doctor. That's what I'm hearing.
Stuart, tell us about sports doping.
Absolutely. Sports doping with Stuart. So a couple of things that I took away from this one.
Yeah. Right on brand. It's good.
So the first thing is there's a few things that really have no evidence that they work, even though they're commonly used in sports doping. It's erythropoietin, human growth hormone, and bronchodilators in general. Interestingly enough, most athletes, from what was being presented, are diagnosed with reactive airways disease because they want to take bronchodilators, and they're also diagnosed with erectile dysfunction because there's some evidence that might suggest that the phosphodiesterase inhibitors could improve performance. However, none of that's really panned out in the data. What does seem to work and is really truly frowned upon is anabolic steroids. But interestingly enough, what works and is legal, and this was from a large meta-analysis, 34 trials published in 2015, is caffeine-containing energy drinks, but in a dose-dependent response to taurine, not to the caffeine. And then another interesting article that was presented, which I found just absolutely hilarious, was that following a high-intensity judo workout, chocolate milk improved recovery. So the take-home point is to...
At this conference, but you're framing it as it was almost a how-to do sports doping.
I hope we don't have any Russian listeners right now.
They're all going to drink mocha lattes with taurine.
Oh boy. I went to Itchy Rashes and Gnarly Nails, which was, I'm sorry, I don't have the speaker's name right in front of me here, but she was from one of the Harvard hospitals. And there was a lot of really usable stuff here. Some of things that overlapped a little bit with our dermatitis episode. One of them was nummular eczema. Sometimes can be hard to tell the difference between that and purpura. So if you take an alcohol wipe, that's right, guys. I'm talking about alcohol pads yet again. So if you wipe off the skin with an alcohol pad, you can see if in patients with dark skin, it can be hard to tell nummular eczema from like purpura. So if you wipe off the skin, you can look for the purple color underneath. If it just looks hyperpigmented, then it's more likely to be something like a nummular eczema than purpura. Also, just reminding you that steroid rankings. Number one is the most potent. Number seven is the least potent. Hydrocortisone would be an example of like a 7, the kind they sell over the counter, and a number 1 would be something like a clobetasol. Ointments, creams, and lotions in that order tend to be have higher oil content. So if you want to moisturize somebody, you're going to start with an ointment or a cream because it has more oil versus a lotion, which has a higher water content. And you should also think that for certain steroids that the ointments might be more potent. They tend to be more potent than creams, which tend to be more potent than lotions. And then I learned that a fingertip unit, if you look at the distal tip of your finger, that is one fingertip unit, and that is about half a gram of cream or ointment. That's enough to cover both palms in general. So the average 70 kilogram man or woman would be covered by about 20 grams of cream or ointment. So think about that when you're prescribing. If someone has a giant rash, then don't prescribe them like 15 grams.
Give them the big tub.
The tub, yeah. So triamcinolone famously comes in a 1-pound jar, which I love to order for patients. She pointed out that bleach baths, there's a recipe for these. Bleach baths, actually, it just amounts to being the same as swimming in a chlorinated pool. So if you have a pool, just swim in your pool. And then she said, I like this phraseology, so I just wanted to put it on the show. If you see a rash that is not round or oval, then it's probably an outside job, meaning it's probably like a contact dermatitis or something like that. So squares and lines, the body doesn't necessarily tend to do that. It likes ovals and circles. And then finally, topical azoles. If you have a rash and you're like, huh, I don't know if this is eczema or something inflammatory or if this is tinea. Well, if you're between putting steroids on it or putting antifungals on it, start with the antifungals, because putting the steroid on it first makes it so that it's going to be hard to tell what you're actually dealing with in the long run if it doesn't work.
It's good to know, because that's how I treat every rash. So
yeah, so you got to flip your practice. That the same thing for me. And the last thing we wanted to talk about today was the press briefing that we went to. The ACP has an initiative on physician well-being and professional satisfaction. And I'll kind of open it to comments. Maybe Paul Williams, you're our expert on the topic. Why don't you tell us what did you take away from that and anything you wanted to point out?
I'm not sure I'm the expert. I think I'm the one who complains about it the most. But so ACP has actually put out a task force that is sort of looking at well-being and professional satisfaction. And they're using a multi-tiered approach. So they're looking at both sort of systemic changes and advocacy on that level and putting patients over paperwork, and then also targeting individual level. So this idea of building resiliency among individual members so that they can sort of tolerate the day-to-day indignities that tend to lead towards more physician burnout. And so there's a couple of prongs that they're utilizing. So they're looking at policy development. They're providing resources and tools, both at a practice level and then also at an individual level. And then they're collaborating with other organizations to sort of reinforce and work on this concept of protecting against burnout.
And the last one is just advocating for internists.
Yes, and advocating for internists, which too much into, even though we're at ACP.
These are all just kind of like buzzwords, right?
Yes.
But unfortunately, these buzzwords only address individual resiliency and not the system-wide issues. And that's kind of, you know, something that
I think part of what they were pointing to is if you want to sell this to your organization that you need to do things, it costs about $500,000 when a burned out physician leaves a practice or it leaves a job and you have to recruit and train someone new.
Right.
And that's how you can sell it to your administrators.
And you've got to be careful to use the leadership language and not necessarily the physician well-being language. So to frame it under the idea of say, hey, let's do this initiative that's focused on physician recruitment and well-being and retention, instead of let's do this initiative that's focused on keeping us happy.
That's a great point.
There's all sorts of like just novel things that you can do to get this. So that one of the speakers whose name maybe it's worth
So the panel who was there would include ACP President Jack Ende, ACP Board of Regents Chair Dr. Susan Thompson Hingle, Dr. Cynthia Smith, and VP Government Affairs and Medical Practice Sherry Erickson.
And the one thing that I wanted to point out, Dr. Smith, she had said that there's like really low cost things you can do. There was a study, she said, just having physicians, they were like, okay, they had one group that could go home an hour or two early, and the other group just ate lunch with colleagues. And like the group that ate lunch with colleagues was like, you know, happier than the group that got to go home early. So I think just like we're stuck in front of the electronic health record so much that just forcing us right to communicate with our colleagues, just a simple thing like that made a difference.
Well, that's why we do what we do right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was heartened by the fact that they recognize that the individual measures are not going to be the big things, but right, the things that we can do quickly. And
yeah,
so
exactly,
it's important to build resilience, but on the other hand, we still need to advocate for systemic change and decrease administrative burden and create a system where it's actually gratifying to take care of patients and you spend more time with patients rather than all the stuff that kind of comes around patient care, which is the thing that burns out providers. So that's the long goal, but in the short term, we still need to provide these tools to help individuals be resilient as we sort of fix the system itself, which is going to take some time.
Just to put a positive spin on this whole thing, I feel the fact that it's such a part of the vernacular now that we're talking about like wellness and hidden curriculums, and the ACP is putting like out such a big push to announce all these things. Like we know about the problem, we are actually working on them, so that at least we have a fighting chance. Whereas I think in the very recent past, none of these things were common to talk about, and so now hopefully things will be getting better.
And I think we'll be able to appeal to the purely mercenary side of healthcare, in that people who are not burnout are going to take better care of patients who are then going to live longer and utilize the health system less. So I think it's now that we're recognizing it, we can study it and actually prove that happier doctors make better doctors.
Yeah. And less $500,000, $500,000 cost of
right
physicians leaving when they're unhappy. And with that, we will end. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
It's okay.
There will be no show notes at thecurbsiders.com, And but you can sign up to receive our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledgefood. You can subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, or send an email to thecurbsiders@gmail.com. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter at The Curbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Watto.
Here with...
I've been...
We got Chris and Chris.
I've been Chris Thrash.
Excellent.
Tonight.
This is Chris Choo Choo.
And this is Dr. Stuart Brigham.
And I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams.
Well, goodbye, Paul.
Okay. Good night, everyone.